Hey everybody, welcome to Two Off the First. It's November the 15th, 2023. We are halfway through the 11th month of the year. It's pretty crazy this year's gone by this quickly, but here we are. We've got plenty to talk about. Something that happened last night, fairly late last night, that's pretty darn surprising, and some analysis of that. And then we'll talk about a story from the LPGA. We'll kick off with that, actually. But before we get to any of that, we are presented by our friends at Swannies. Check them out, swannies.co. Use the promo code GolfNewsNet25. To get 25% off that first order. Black Friday is coming if you want to get in ahead of that. They will probably clear out a ton of their stuff. They have some really awesome new hoodies they just put out that are like Christmas winter themed that I'm going to be all over. Either with like inside lining with kind of the winter Christmas theme or right on the outside. They look great. They're awesome. They're the same price as the regular hoodies, just with the cool design in them just for this season. So check them out, swannies.co, promo code GolfNewsNet25. All right, let's start with the LPGA, because that was the second piece of news and the more kind of staggering piece of news, I think, that's going to take more time is from last night. So the news in the LPGA, actually, there's really two things to talk about, but we'll lump them together. So this morning, the LPGA announced a two-year extension with CME Group as the title sponsor of their season-long points race, which is the race to the CME Globe, and the season-ending tournament, which is the CME Group Tour Championship, which is coincidentally being played this week. So that means the contract was running out after this week. They came to an agreement. They came to a two-year extension. And that unto itself is fairly extraordinary. And the reason I say that is because last year was a total debacle from an LPGA player relations standpoint. And that really all stemmed from players not showing up to a pro-am party dinner where CME is out there, Terry Duffy, who is a huge supporter of women's golf and the LPGA, he wants to kind of acknowledge players who he expects who are going to be in the crowd, and they kind of turn the lights on the room, and they want them to stand up, and there's like no one there. And Terry Duffy's embarrassed. He's not happy. It turned into a thing. Golf Week did a story about it. Molly Marco-Salmon had to come out and explain it and say, you know, kind of say, my bad, you know, I didn't communicate well enough to the players that they should be there. And all that, I mean, it started kind of a long string of conversations about Marco-Salmon and her capacity as the commissioner of the LPGA, how Mike Wann would have handled that or never let that happen or whatever. That, you know, Terry Duffy said, you know, I really want to support this, but basically implying if you're going to screw it up, you're making it hard on yourself. So that they came to the table and agreed to this extension, for one, in any capacity, is great. It's 2 years tells you something, though. Tells you that CME wants to see some things. That you don't do a two-year extension unless you're kind of skeptical about the next one. Or that you aren't particularly happy about this one and you want to dangle something over their head. Like, oh, the clock's ticking. We better do this right. If you don't do this right, we're not keeping this thing going. So that term length means something. And then second, the big news in taking out the analysis of the politics and how things were handled in terms of reputation and relationship last year, the big headline is that the purse for this tournament is increasing big time from $7 million to $11 million for the next 2 years. And that $11 million purse for a 60-player field will award a $4 million first place prize to the winner of the CME Group Tour Championship. That is, it already has the largest single payday from a tournament in women's golf. Because if you look at the other majors, the ones that are at that, you know, $10 million range in terms of prize money, they pay out 18%. So for the US Open, a $10 million purse is a $1.8 million payday, which is why the payday for this tournament is $2 million, so that you know that you're getting the season end with the biggest payday. That's how they wanted to design it. Well, now it's definitely going to be more than anybody, even if the majors somehow come along and get to $15 million, which I'm not saying is going to happen anytime soon. That arms race is probably quieted down for a while. But this tournament will by far, and not even close, have the biggest first-place payday. In addition, it will also have a seven-figure payday for second place. The second-place finisher moving forward will get $1 million. And then they're going to change the payout structure a little bit so that every player who qualifies gets at least $55,000 for showing up, which is a nice touch. It's about $40,000 now, so a minimum $15,000 raise for showing up. Hey, that's cool for everybody. It's an acknowledgement of a good season to get into the top 16 points and get to this tournament. So that's a great thing. It's great to see CME doing this. They also had another kind of momentous moment on the Epson Tour, where Carlisle is the sponsor of the Arizona Women's Classic or Open. I forget whether it's Classic or Open. But anyway, it's a good tournament on the schedule. They had like a $335,000 purse. They were trying to match French Lick Resort, which had the biggest purse on the Epson Tour. Now, French Lick is not going to be part of the Epson Tour schedule. They are now hosting the season-ending event on the Korn Ferry Tour. So Carlisle has stepped in and raised the bar. They will now raise the purse of their event to $400,000, meaning $60,000 goes to the winner. They pay 15% to the winner on the Epson Tour and the LPGA Tour. So that's a big deal. The money that has come into women's golf in the last few years has really been huge. I mean, it has changed tremendously because they have found sponsors who believe in the value of women's professional golf, believe in the value of the product, are willing to put money behind it, are willing to raise the bar so that other sponsors that come along can raise the bar too and kind of lifts all boats a little bit. And that doesn't work across the board. There are still sponsors from kind of a different era of the LPGA that want to kind of keep the purse around $1.5 to $2 million, and they're going to kind of be grandfathered into this idea now that you kind of have to have a minimum $3 million purse if you want to do an event on the LPGA. And those will eventually either step up or move out. I don't know. But things are changing pretty quickly, money-wise, in women's golf. And I don't think it has a darn thing to do with LIV, or the PGA Tour stuff, the Saudis. I mean, to a degree, yes, because the money gap between the biggest events in the PGA Tour and LIV, that rose exponentially in the last couple of years. And I think these sponsors, particularly in the majors and the LPGA, said, look, we can't have this gap be this big. We need to step up and increase it and kind of get closer. But not just because that happens, but because they care about getting closer to parity with the PGA Tour. And then, you know, obviously LIV's come along. You're not going to outspend them. But I guess in a backdoor way, yeah, LIV is somewhat responsible. Not entirely, not encouraging it, but the sponsors that have really taken to the LPGA and have been part of the big increase in prize money have said, we need to kind of keep pace, so we're going to do that. And the end result's a huge influx of money to the sport, which, hey, that's a good thing. I'm not going to knock that in the end. All right, let's go ahead and take a break. We'll come back. We'll talk about the second story right after this. If you're like me, you've wanted to buy gold for years. Lots of commercials out there, but who can you really trust? I don't want a bad investment, but didn't want to miss the boat either. Sound familiar? Fortunately, I've got great news. If you have an IRA or 401k and want to buy physical gold, eliminate fear and uncertainty from the process using the new Gold IRA Company Integrity Checklist. It helps you evaluate and choose the best gold IRA company. I used it personally to vet Augusta Precious Metals, and they are absolutely phenomenal. Use this checklist to choose the best gold IRA company. Text to get your free Gold IRA Company Integrity Checklist today. Text GOLF to 68592. Again, text GOLF to 68592. That's GOLF to 68592. Or go to AugustaPreciousMetals.com. Okay, welcome back to the show. Second story today is a fairly surprising one, I think, in some ways, and then not in others. So last night, Ryan French, who owns my Monday Q Info, check him out, mondayqinfo.com, join there. He does a great job. Him and Mark Baldwin just do fantastic stuff. He broke the news that Rory McIlroy had resigned from the PGA Tour Policy Board as a player director. So he will be replaced. That nominee, based on the letter Jay Monahan sent to players in response, acknowledging this resignation last night, said the other player directors will come together and figure out a replacement to serve out the rest of McElroy's term, which is through the end of 2024. Patrick Cantlay keeps going, so that we'll talk about that in a second, and McElroy will have to be replaced. Now, Monahan has this letter that goes out to the players and talks about his accomplishments as a part of the policy board and his time and his commitment, and basically says McElroy's leaving the board role because of personal and professional commitments. Of course, he's one of the co-founders of TGL. He's going to play in that. Obviously, he plays on the DP World Tour. He has a ton of influence there. He plays a global schedule. He's a dad. And he has talked repeatedly over the last year and change about how draining it has been to be so intimately involved in the reshaping of the PGA Tour. Whether you agree with it or don't, he's put in a lot of hours to it. And I think he believes that is to his detriment, despite the fact that he has been in the top 15 or top 10 of 7 of the last 8 majors played. I mean, he's arguably never been more consistent of a player. Maybe not winning as much, but never been as consistent as a player. 2 wins this year, FedEx Cup last year, had a great year last year. I mean, he's been arguably as good as he's ever been, except in the majors and winning them. But in terms of consistency, he never been better either. So on one hand, he's probably thinking, I've done all of this stuff inspired by kind of the spite and dislike of Greg Norman and Liv and wanting it to go away, and been inspired because he wanted to not embarrass himself as he puts himself out there as the public face of the PGA Tour. But what could I do more if I didn't have to worry about that all the time? And maybe he feels a couple of things. And this is sheer speculation, of course. One, you have to wonder, does he like who he's working with? I mean, he has come out and out and called Patrick Cantlay a dick in an interview with Paul Kimmage, who he speaks with most years, who's at the Irish Independent. Paul Kimmage is great, and they have such a great rapport, and Rory gives him such great stuff. And he out and out called Patrick Cantlay a dick, and then talked about the Joe LaCava incident, the Hatgate, the Ryder Cup, and said LaCava was a great guy when he was with Tiger, and that he adopted the personality of his new guy, who's a dick. So, and nobody that I know, other than, I don't even know anybody in golf that I know personally that loves Patrick Cantlay. I mean, I know Xander Schauffele and Patrick Cantlay are friends, and I'm sure he has some other friends, but there are not many people who like Patrick Cantlay. And I wonder if Rory just kind of said, you know what, this thing with the Saudis and the investment stuff, it's been too much. It's not going anywhere. It's seemingly not going anywhere. He has said publicly, the company line, you know, I want the PIF to be involved. I hope they're involved in the final product. Meanwhile, you've got Fenway Sports Group that owns the team in TGL that he plays for. They're obviously an investor in this concept of this league that he co-owns. He almost certainly wants them to be a part of it too. And in what way, I don't know. But we'll find that out, I suppose. And you've got, again, the toll that all of this has taken. If this is going to drag on, and all indications are that it might, because for however long the Saudis and the PGA Tour and the DP World Tour agree to keep the negotiating period open, even if they agree to extend it beyond the end of this year, Rory's got to be involved with that. That's not fun. And then if the Saudis don't wind up being part of the investment group, there's a whole other wave of crap that's coming their way, because the Saudis could do multiple things. They could agree, this Liv thing's not working for us, we're going to shut it down. Could be, we're going to invest in both. They could negotiate a future where Liv exists, but they're also an investor in the PGA Tour. Or it could be separate. It could be all together. Lots of things can happen. There's nothing written in stone. Or you could have a universe where it just gets messy for months on end, that they still keep trying to agree to something and it's not coming together, and then they just decide, you know what, we're going to keep negotiating forever, and that's going to take up time and space. Meanwhile, McElroy has an ally on the board now in Tiger Woods, who he knows they have a shared interest, because they both own TGL, and they both are extremely influential players. They're looking after their legacies and what they believe they've built together. So And obviously Tiger built more, but nevertheless, I think Rory can say, all right, I could step away now because Tiger's involved. He's intimately involved. He cares about the details. I can focus on some other stuff. I can do some of the TGL stuff, and we can make this work together, working together instead of, but separately in some ways, while at the same time working together on spot things. So I think there's probably a bunch of things that have come together here. Probably not a fan of Cantlay. Probably knows he's got backup. Probably tired of all of this. It's with McIlroy, it's never just like one thing. There's never just one reason. I mean, I'm sure there are decisions like that in his life. But in something like this, I don't think it's as simple as any of those one thing took precedent over the other things. I don't think that's the case. But it is interesting that he's now out the door and didn't even wait to get to 2024 before he walked away. He's like, I'm done here now. We're out of here. And it could be one thing I will throw out there also, discomfort with the process. I mean, he has said multiple times that if the public investment fund wants to invest in golf, he will welcome it so long as it is kind of inevitable, unavoidable, and that it is within the confines of the existing golf infrastructure. But what if that's not it? What if the Saudis say, well, we're only going to agree to this if we can keep the live stuff around? And he's like, I'm not signing on to that. I'm not putting my name down to that. After all this time and everything I said in public, I'm not doing that. I'll throw that out there as a potential option too. So there's a lot of different reasons why this could have happened, different degrees, different amounts of influence. But I think all of them are probably pretty relevant. Still, nevertheless, I think what McIlroy has done or has had influence over is going to shape the PGA Tour for truly decades. I mean, for the rest of his life, what happened in these last 18-ish months, 24 months, are going to be associated with him and are going to shape the business of the PGA Tour. That's a lot of influence. That's a heavy burden for someone to carry, and most people who are in these types of situations don't do it forever. They do it for as long as they can stand it, and then they get out of the way and hope that what they did can stand up. I think this is one of those situations. So, interesting change, interesting timing of it all, especially as you lead into the DP World Tour Championship in Dubai. You've got that season-ending event on the DP World Tour. He's over there doing that. Sends his resignation letter. So, you presume he had it written and ready to roll and got it to Monahan yesterday afternoon. And that this was thought out, not just like, all right, well, I'm sick of all this, I'm out of here. But you never know. And someday, McIlroy will probably give some clue, peel back the curtain a little bit about why all of this happened and why it happened now and those types of things. But I don't anticipate him just giving like the full story of, all right, well, this is why I did this. And, you know, that's it. And here's everything. And I don't think that's going to happen either. So, pretty intriguing story if you've been following this thing the last couple of years. But I do want to point out something that he said at the DP World Tour Championship that I thought was important. I think it was the DP World Tour Championship. That I thought was important. That he said he thought some of the money that was being invested in golf by the Saudis, if they do it, or from whatever private equity, that it goes toward increasing participation in the game at a recreational level. He wants some of this money thrown at the RNA and the USGA. Now, I appreciate him saying that, and I appreciate the sentiment behind it. However, I kind of disagree. And the reason I disagree is not because I have any animus toward either of those organizations. They're great. They have tons and tons and tons of money already. And the USGA gets a enormous sum of money in terms of media rights. Now, some of that, half of that's paid by Fox every year, and half of that's paid by the folks at NBC Sports, NBC Universal, and I understand that. But they don't necessarily need that much more money. What probably needs to happen in terms of participation increases and funding, that kind of thing, That's not at a USGA and an RNA level necessarily, unless they are kind of the pass through. They are the people who take the money and then pass it through to a local level. And that kind of comes into an interesting thing I saw, I think it was yesterday, from the Aspen Institute. And there's, I think his name is like Joe Pampliano. He does like a lot of sports business stuff, and I see him retweeted in my timeline time and again. And he's a very skilled aggregator of this stuff related to sports business, and tweets in a very specific fashion. And anyhow, he shared a graphic from the Aspen Institute, which tracks these kinds of things. They're kind of a think tank. Back in the day, I used to work for a think tank, but that was, oh gosh, 17 years ago. And this particular set of data was talking about sports participation, and that we've seen a decline in a number of sports in terms of participation: baseball, basketball, football, hockey, compared to individual sports like tennis and golf. Golf's, at least by the numbers reported, seen something like a 30% increase in youth participation. However, that is from National Golf Foundation data. National Golf Foundation has changed in the last few years what they consider golfers to be. So you could be an off-course golfer, someone who plays at a driving range or a top golf or even mini, I don't know if mini golf counts, but you know, golf-adjacent forms of playing the game without necessarily having to play on a golf course. So I don't know how much of that 30% increase is due to that or due to the pandemic and people getting involved in the sport, due to more emphasis on individual sports in the pandemic, and that's kind of stuck. Those types of things. There are probably, again, a number of factors at play. There's almost never just one explanation for something. And I think taking in the perspective that whatever that increase is on course isn't because of things the governing bodies do marketing-wise. It's what they do to help make golf better from an agronomy standpoint, trying to influence culture in terms of being more welcoming to children, families, not just middle-aged white guys that show up on weekends, which I'm a middle-aged white guy. I mean, I'm the clientele. But at the same time, if you want the next generation to take up golf and you want them to take it up sooner, then you want them to play as kids. You want them to be welcome on the golf course. And I think some of that has started to change. The culture of golf has started to change a little bit, where it's cool if you're a kid that plays golf. It's cool to bring your kid to play golf. It's been a lovely experience to take my son out and play golf. People are really welcoming. They love to have him out there. He's got good energy. He's fun to be around. And I realize that my kid's not always like that, and not every kid is like that, but it used to be, I think, perceived as more of a drag to have kids out there. And now I think more clubs and courses are actively trying to encourage that. We've got Junior League, which is nice. It's not perfect, but it's nice. You've got U.S. Kids Golf. You've got all kinds of infrastructure out there to foster kids taking up the game of golf. That's what you need. You need infrastructure and great experience. That's what does it. So while I agree with McElroy's idea that some of the money being thrown at professional golf should also be thrown back toward fostering the future of the game, I don't know exactly how best to do that. So I don't completely agree with them, but I agree with the sentiment behind it. And maybe that's what matters. And then the last thing I want to talk about today, and this is really quick, and then we will touch on it tomorrow a little bit more in depth, but I did just want to talk about it here, in that a memo sent to players, I think it was on Tuesday, from Jay Monahan, did suggest that there will be an opportunity for players and PGA Tour members to have some kind of equity stake in the new company. Something. We don't know what that looks like. Don't know exactly how that's going to work. But Monahan said in his memo, quote, "At the point we secure outside investment, this would be a unique offering in professional sports, as no other league grants its players and members direct equity ownership in the league's business. We recognize, as do all of the prospective minority investors who are in dialogue with us, that the PGA Tour will be stronger with our players, more closely aligned with the commercial success of the business," end quote. And what that gets into and what that means based on what they've said in the past, and Phil Mickelson taking a victory lap on X, and all of this stuff we'll talk about tomorrow. But I think that's a really interesting kind of way to transition to tomorrow's show and what we'll talk about there. So we will talk about this tomorrow. We'll talk about another story tomorrow on the show. Thanks so much for being with us. I appreciate it. It's been interesting doing the show this year kind of in full and covering so many different things related to golf. And obviously a lot of time we've spent on this show talking about LIV, and I've acknowledged my biases against LIV and the source of the money, and that I don't think it's a particularly competitive product. And I thought it was really interesting that someone reached out, someone gave the show a negative review because they don't like my perspective on that. And I'm totally fine with that. I mean, it's just a podcast. Like, this doesn't really matter. But I do think it's interesting that they could have given the show a 0-star review and they gave it a 2-star review. And I just kind of laughed about that because it could have been nothing. But they at least thought enough to say, the show's not bad. I just totally disagree with what you say. And I'm totally fine with that. If I don't do this so that you agree with me. In fact, it'd be kind of better if sometimes you don't. And sometimes you do. Because then that makes it more lively. We talk to each other. We hash out ideas. That's the whole point of all of this, is to talk about ideas. Talk about concepts. Work through them. I'll give you my views because I'm the guy talking to the microphone. But I want to hear your views too. If you completely disagree with me, that's totally fine. I actually welcome that. I want that to happen. Earlier in my life, I didn't want that so much. And sometimes criticism absolutely stings. But hey, we're all different people. We all have different views. We all come from different places. So if you've got something to disagree with me about, I want to hear from you. Whether that's in the form of a negative review, maybe not so much, but I would love for you to talk to me. That's why we do this. Start a conversation. So whether that's on Twitter, X, Threads, or Instagram at Ryan Bellingy, whether that's through Apple reviews, whether that's through Spotify reviews, whether that's through email, ryanofthegolfnewsnet.com, any of those things. Happy to talk to you about this. Anything that we cover on the show, I very much appreciate you listening and what you have to say and your perspective on things. I'll be back tomorrow with another show. Thanks so much for listening. We'll catch you next time on Two Off the First.